In an effort to lessen distractions to others and to respect our speakers, we ask that you please take a moment to silence and put away your cell phones and other electronic devices. In addition, we ask that you only have kosher approved food and drink to respect our host, the temple. My name is Danny, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Danny.
This is an open meeting of the Beacon Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place so all who wish to may recover from alcoholism. Therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any outside behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. For more information about safety in AA, see AA the safety card and the AA safety card and safety in AA are common welfare. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer.
God, bring me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
John will read the steps.
Yeah, John.
I'm John, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
Here are the steps we took. One, we had admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, John. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. All our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA statements of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask that all our speakers to identify by their first name only, to refrain from using profanity, please. Tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Sarah. Oh, Lord. Woo! Woo! Woo!
Hi. Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sarah.
Oops, I forgot they wouldn't be able to see me. I'm an alcoholic. It's my first time speaking at this meeting. Thank you for welcoming me. My sobriety date is June 15th, 2022, and I have to open my notebook so I don't forget what I'm doing here, which is sharing my experience, strength, and hope, which is what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I'm getting over a little cold, I'm good, but I will bless all this mic down after. And I just need to invite my higher power in now, which is something my sponsor suggested I do before speaking if I'm nervous or whenever. and I have a very like daily, minute by minute, conscious relationship with an HP today, and I'm very, very grateful for that. And I wouldn't have felt motivated if I hadn't come to this room on a, like a Monday, I think, about a year or maybe a little bit more after I first got sober. And I grew up in Brookline, and so I have a lot of resentment toward coming to meetings in the area because there's a lot of pain that I feel does not go spoken about in Brookline, and there's a lot of swept under the rug alcoholism that happens in Brookline. And it reminds me of like the world I live in which a lot of that is happening always, everywhere. And I grew up in a family of alcoholics and mentally ill people. I grew up the youngest of three by like 10 plus years and saw what alcoholism looked like. And basically my story right now where I'm at, like a year plus some, is feeling like I get to define what my boundaries are, what my alcoholism is, what my recovery looks like on a basis of what I've learned and what I continue to learn with a sponsor and with fellowship and with the steps. And so why I said that is because alcoholism and addiction and mentally ill people looked so different than how I identified and how I felt as a child. So like at 8 years old, I looked like a boy. I wanted to be called Michael, and I was Michael. And I was really deeply like eager to die by age 10. And I didn't try to die, but the people who tried to die went to hospitals or had therapists. And overall, I don't claim to be like a neglected child, but I do think there was a lot that I slowly over teen years was like, okay, I'm good because I don't have that. I don't have what they have. And AA tells me so strongly that I get to identify with a person up here, and I like, I must, in order to know that like why I'm here is so painful and why I'm here is so insidious and so comforting and also so secretive that like I might not tell myself how painful I feel. And I'm like pausing my fourth step, and I'm about to talk to my sponsor about it, because I'm having a lot of conflicting feelings about the trauma that's coming up for me. And a big gift of AA has been accepting trauma therapy as part of my work as an alcoholic woman and many other things I am. Did you raise your hand?
No.
Oh. Okay, gotta slow down. So, in high school, my cousin, who I identified as like the alcoholic, so lots of like hardcore drugs and like tattoos and like he might as well have had a motorcycle. He did his ninth step with me, and I had just started smoking weed. And I was like, yo, are we gonna like smoke some weed? And then he was like, went into this whole thing about like what he took from me and my parents and what his connection was to his HP, because obviously we were like, what is this program? Like, what are you doing? And it was that moment that I realized I really did believe in a power greater than all of us, and that park, and it was called Emerson Park in Brookline. And okay, thanks. And so I think that was my first shaking hands with belief, but I went into like drugs, relationships, like college right away, like basically failed out of high school but didn't. And then like got really, really mentally ill in college, went away to Glasgow to do a study abroad thing. It was very like fun, but very drunk. And then COVID happened, so we all moved home and back home. And that's when I went into a really big psychosis, which is a big part of my story. And through that, the hand of AA came back to me through the back door of Al-Anon. And I just say that because someone said that in a meeting and I was like, whoa, I'm not alone, cool. And so if anyone's feeling that way, I always assume in Beacon, no one, everyone probably feels apart, but it's helpful for me to say that because I wouldn't have known that AA could be for me if I didn't actually hear someone say, we think you might be one of us. And again, it went back to that childhood thing of like, I'm not that. And so AA really gave me the opportunity to say, like, I am. And I'm now doing, like, a bunch of meditation that came into my life after one of my siblings recommended it for, like, the 28th time. And so I do that with them every Tuesday. And a lot of that feels so amplified and just, like, this, like, little infinity with AA. I was gonna like quote something, but I don't have time. But I do feel very grateful to slow down. And what happened was I just went to that meeting that they recommended I go to. It was a young people meeting, the street, Brooklyn Young People. And I didn't go to that all the time, but the people in there showed me where my home group ended up being. And then through that I got service positions and I met some like really amazing people I feel very close to today and really look up to as fellows and also friends and people of the world. And I think my love for AA is that I feel like an actual human, like I don't know if I would have felt that at some point at age like 23, maybe I would have been like, oh cool, that's what being a human is. But like, I'm happy that the legs I have and like the heart I feel is beating is like from AA and from not just like pain, like, oh, like through pain, I'm all cool. But like, I think there is this like deep, like crazy cosmic thing that's happening here, which is like that we're doing it for so long. And then like, I'm now accepting what my brother practices, which is Judaism. And I get to be like, cool, how do I accept more of my like Jewish identity today too? How do I disregard some of the stuff I don't need to hear? Like, take what you like, leave the rest. Like, all these things make so much sense. And I just feel a little more patient with myself. I still think I'm the most scared person I know. So I really have to work on that. And I look forward to that. But I'm glad I got to say, like, yeah, I can speak tonight, you know? Like, that's so simple. Or like, I know where the bathrooms are. Like, coming to a meeting early on, it was like, I don't know what the F or the F anything is. And that's kind of like, I don't know how to start my homework, which I didn't know how to do in fifth grade. And like, I don't know, like, if I don't know that I must be like unsafe. And I think with this strong fellowship that I do feel, even though I'm not like a member of Beacon, I feel very like at home here. So thank you, is this feeling of like, and then the power to travel again. Like that's a goal of mine, is like, I know how I could set up my travel plans around meetings. And that's because you all like also show how to do that. And I think that could be figurative as well as like a literal, like I'm going to visit family in France or something. And knowing what I have to do, my mom on the way here, she dropped me off, was saying like, yeah, it seems like a lot of you knowing how to structure your time, which used to be really hard for you, do you have ADHD, is like based around AA. I wouldn't want it any other way, literally. I still get existential about my life. And I know that you guys feel that way too. Thank you. So I just know that most things are gonna be okay. And as my friend says, like, you just sit with not knowing. So I'll keep doing that. Thank you for letting me share. Hope you have a good night. Drink some water.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm glad we got to hear you too. All right, we'll now observe the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. We We're going to pass the basket now, but you may also observe the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. There's a QR code in the basket that's being passed around, and our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. That's @beacon-group. Although there are no dues or fees for a membership, we do have expenses. Our rent here is $200 per month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Ramiro. Thank you, Ramiro, with any questions, and we thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions, which apply to the group in the same manner the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Jim has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Thank you, Danny. Hi, my name's Jim. I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Jim.
Okay, the 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personnel.
Thank you, Mr. Jim. Beacon Group is run by a business meeting, which meets on the third Wednesday of each month directly after the meeting in person and online. Hi, online people. This is your opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise their hands? Thank you. And now let's welcome our second 10-minute speaker, Joel.
So my name is Joel. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Joel.
I'd like to read from page 68 of the big book. It says, perhaps there's a better way. We think so. But we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust the infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? And I really adore that passage. That's probably, I turn back to that over and over again. My sobriety date is May 25th, 2014. I have a sponsor. My sponsor knows he's my sponsor. And I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring other men through this program. And it has been a ride. It's been really, really good. So I don't have much time to talk about the mess, which is convenient because not much to say that you probably don't already know, can't already probably guess from me being up here, but to keep it brief, it started early and I stopped early, or I was stopped early. I first drank when I was 14. I was full of like angst and anger, and there was a lot of heavy family stuff that had just happened in a couple of years prior. And when I drank, I felt free. When I drank, I felt like I could really be myself, and I didn't worry about if I was okay. I didn't worry if anybody thought it was cool, if I said the right thing, if I dressed the right way. All that stuff, all of my self-consciousness melted away the first time I drank. And drinking quickly became problematic. I almost died drinking alone when I was 15. I told myself I would drink a drink of brandy after everyone had gone to bed. Knowing if I had more, they would have caught me. And I woke up in a hospital and I found out that I drank almost the entire bottle of brandy. I went to bed, started vomiting, started asphyxiating on my vomit, and my brother woke up to the sound of me choking and saved my life. And that's how alcohol started with me. So it didn't get much better than that, to be honest with you. So, you know, my drinking career was basically 9 years of working hard and playing hard. And I did well in school, and I almost did well in school as a self-defense mechanism because it allowed me to, it gave me a certain sense of self-righteousness the way I was drinking. I had a certain kind of pride that I can still do well in school and yet, you know, hang in with all these other kids. And there was a part of me that really protected those times that I went out drinking, because it's some of the only times I felt free. And you know, for what it's worth, during those years, that lack of control never got any better. We call it the phenomenon of craving, the allergy. I have that. Every time I drink, I get drunk without wanting to, without meaning to. Even when I desperately want to, I can't. People threw all sorts of, you know, big highfalutin ideas my way, like moderation, and that sounded really attractive to me. It sounded really, really good, and I never succeeded. And I tried sincerely for probably the last 4 years of my drinking. You know, drove drunk all the time, drove drunk, blacked out. I was suicidal. I was depressed. All that kind of stuff was going on in my life. After college, I got sober for 6 months under the theory that I could drink again normally if I stopped for a while. I did stop for a while. I was more suicidal than I'd ever been in my life, even though I was stone cold sober. And I started drinking again, hoping that little problem would go away, and it didn't. And it was right back to where I was 6 months prior. So I was stopped in May of 2014. I was 23, and basically a bunch of circumstances sort of arranged in a way where it was made just abundantly clear to me that I cannot bet my car, the farm, my life, your life on trying to stay sober. That I just cannot drink safely, period. And that if I don't get sober, I'm gonna die. And I just felt that really deep down. I was an atheist at the time too, worth talking about, because this would be a big part of my next topic. So I was an atheist and I was like a teenager, kind of went along well with the whole drinking and trying to find my own happiness thing. It wasn't a good look, you know? So I came to AA because I knew that AA worked. That's all I knew about AA, that people came here, they got sober, they stayed sober for a long time, and they were happy, and that it worked. And there was something about that that was really comforting and really, really cool. But when I came here, I saw all the words, I saw the God word on the wall, on the window shade, and I was like, oh boy, here are the God people, you know? And man, the joke's on me, because now I'm one of the God people. Like, oh my goodness, I thought I was throwing God as far away as possible, but he was a boomerang. He came right back around and hit me upside the head. So a big part of the last 9 years has been learning about why I drink, actually. What my problem actually is. And my problem actually is not just that I have this allergy, much as that's a huge problem. The problem is that I can't stop starting. And that when I say I'm an alcoholic, I don't just mean that I can't drink, I mean that I will drink. I heard someone say it that way, and it makes a lot of sense to me, that I unaided, I will drink. And it's not because, you know, a Mai Tai with a little umbrella sounds so good to drink on a beach. Like, I really had no romantic thoughts about what that would be like, but I drink as an act of self-hatred. I drink as an act of self-destruction. I drink because I have feelings that I don't know how to handle. I drink over family. I drink over friends. I drink over unrealized ambitions. I drink over anxieties. I drink over victories and times when I feel superior to other people, you know, and that's kind of like, that's really why I drink. And those are the kind of feelings that today I need help navigating those things sober. I need something that is way bigger than me. to take those problems from me. You know, when I say that they're set, take away my difficulties, like those are really the difficulties that I'm talking about here, is the way that I approach the world. I approach the world in a way where it's inevitable that I'll drink. So when I came in touch with this higher power, this God idea, it was really scary at first. And now it is the anchor of my life. It's the absolute cornerstone on everything else that I am building is sort of is founded on. And a big part of that is learning how to set in the passage to trust that I'm okay, that when I'm having anxieties, worries about my work, about my family, about money, about anything, that I trust that my higher power is taking care of me, even when it's hard, even when it's bad, and it has been hard, and it has been bad. There have been moments of calamity. There have been deaths. There have been breakups. There have been really turbulent moves. But there's also been a lot of joy, and there's been a deep happiness that I feel when I'm just walking around my life. And I never knew what that was about. I never knew what that all really meant. But this morning, you know, like these days, I wake up and I feel deeply that I'm a friend to myself, you know? And that's a really beautiful, special thing that I never had before I came to AA. And, you know, a big part of this is like, for me, I don't do the 12 steps so that I can earn God's love. You know, the way the steps are ordered are beautiful. They're ordered that way for a reason. And the truth is that, like, I came to a third step with nothing to offer a higher power but the body and mind I had spent the last, like, decade just defiling and destroying. And God was stoked. He wasn't even just like, yeah, okay, yeah, I guess I'll let you squeeze by. He's, like, excited to even see my face coming up over the hill, you know? And that we do this stuff in the latter steps so that the consciousness of my belief will come to me, you know? So that I can feel, so that I can consciously see that there is a love that's bigger than me that's holding me together, you know? And so today, walking by faith really just means that, like, I'm like a kid in the supermarket, and God's like my dad, and I'm just there, like, holding his hand, you know? Just walking around. Like, I have no idea where I'm going. I don't need to know. All I know is that you're right here. And because you're right here, I'm going to be fine. And that every single experience I have will be a rife opportunity for me to grow, and that growth is needed, growth is wanted, and that when we give it away and help others grow too, there is something just that is so sweet and so powerful that emerges in these rooms. So really grateful to be here, and hopefully excited to get to know you all better. Thanks.
We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our job coordinator, Ramiro, after the meeting. We'll get you set up. And now let's welcome our main speaker, Ashley.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ashley.
Hi, Ashley.
So good to see you. Thanks so much for having me. Hi to our online community. I have a sobriety date. It's the 30th of December, 2006. It's a really special date to me. I'm hoping with AA and Higher Power's help and a sponsor's help, I can hang on to it. It was also my papa's belly button birthday, and he was an alcoholic, and he didn't have the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I kind of think that my sobriety date is a little bit of a wink and a nudge and some love from my beloved granddaddy from Appalachia. I did hear from his second wife, who was so good to me, that when they fussed, he could drive across the river over to West Virginia and sometimes find an AA meeting. So it wasn't totally unknown to him that he had a problem and that there was a solution. But I'm really grateful today that I stand in this sobriety date with a little bit of both love from him and being able to grow out of the family pain from which I came. I claim the Beacon Group is my home group. I'm not here very much, so I'm not a good model for that. Having some sleep issues and not making the 8 o'clock. But I do go to meetings elsewhere as well. But I love this group. I love the structure. I appreciate its dedication to the 36 Principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I also have a sponsor, and I love and adore her, and she's really neat. She's very we're real clear with each other, and yet she does things in a way that's very kind and very firm and very gentle. And I value that because I came from a lot of harshness. And I have the pleasure and honor of sponsoring other women. And I did mention the 36 principles, and so I want to talk tonight, if HP and I have this in mind together, about this, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts of service. Because to me, it takes all of those to have this life that is happy, joyous, and free, you know, not to be glum, to avoid the deliberate manufacture of misery, and all those things that the book talks about. So first, I just want to share, I do come from the family disease of alcoholism, and that looked real ugly in my family. My great-grandmommy murdered my great-granddaddy, and she was a flophouse street alcoholic and burned down the family business and left the state with all the money. And when she died and someone went to my nana's door to say, hey, your mom's dead, my nana said, well, what does that have to do with me? Because she was so traumatized and just had so much pain from the way in which she had been raised and not been raised. And so when I drank, it looked really different because I didn't want to do alcoholism that way, right? So I dressed my alcoholism up. I put a cocktail ring on it. I put a fancy dress on it. And if I saw you, oh, I upgraded our friendship. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen each other in a long time. We should get a good bottle of wine. So that's what alcoholism kind of looked like for me. And I did drink alone sometimes, but that was, you know, a hostess's cocktail before the guests arrived. So I had all these codes and ways of disguising it, concealing it to myself, as I've heard my sponsor talk about in my 10th step, how I learned not to conceal things from myself anymore. And I did some really, you know, foolish things, like one night I, which wasn't totally unheard of, made myself get sick so I would have hopefully less of a hangover and get the alcohol out of my system. But then I started having these quasi-religious experiences with all this profound insight, and I really needed to share this wisdom with someone who could appreciate where I was coming from. So I called myself and left myself a voicemail, because I was such good company. And the next morning when I listened to my voicemail, because that's the first thing you do, right? How popular were you the night before? And I heard this gibberish, incomprehensible nonsense, and I was like, oh, wow, that's me. And when I read that in a first step to my first sponsor, she said, Ashley, you know, that's not sane behavior. That's not sane behavior. And so that took me to my step two, you know. And I don't need to tell you anymore what alcoholism looks like. Y'all think know pretty well having your rear ends in these chairs. And, you know, step two to me is a really beautiful step in AA because it's linked to our preamble, which talks, as was read, that we're not allied with any sect or denomination or institution or politics. And everyone is given the dignity, and that includes me, of finding a God of their own understanding. And the book really encourages this and says, you know, and if the word God prejudices you, try not to let it. And one of my steps two assignments was to go through the chapter to the agnostic and write down all the spiritual terms that are used as a placeholder for higher power, spirit of the universe, creative intelligence, all of that, and define what it means for me. You know, and my step two is a renewing experience. I have these different relationships with different, not gods of my understanding, but different intimacies with higher power in different ways. And one of my step two stories was, I was in an African place where I spend a lot of time, and it's a really tough context. It's, you know, it's a failed state. It's by all the indices the fourth worst country in the world, and there's just a lot of suffering. And I was suffering this one night. And so I just couldn't get a grip. You know, I dropped my basket, as we say in the South, and I was having this come apart, and I was there to be of service, and I wasn't going to be useful to anybody. And so I thought, this is a step two dilemma, right? What is the step two proposition? God is everything or God is nothing. And so I started to think, I have the opportunity to connect with a new God of my understanding. And what is that going to be? So it was going to be real big, right? It was going to be bigger than geopolitics, because that's a real spiritual place to start. And bigger than conflict mineral mining, and bigger than gang rape by militia, and scores of women, and all this stuff. And it just wasn't working. I was really trying to force this solution. And I kept getting more upset instead of calming down. I thought, why isn't this working? And so I opened up this little envelope with which I travel, and out fell a picture of my kitty cat. I'd cut pictures of my mom, had actually, bless her. She had cut the little animals into tiny little pictures for me, and it reminded me of Percy, my kitty, who would share a pillow with me and bathe himself and groom me at the same time, and then we would fall asleep holding hands. And then he would wake up and groom himself again. Cats are very tidy. And I would think, oh, my heart would be so torn because I didn't want to put him out because he was so dear, and yet I really needed to sleep. So I would put him out, and I would feel all this guilt, and the next morning I would open the door, and he would be winking at me with not a punishing bone in his body, just like, hello, I love you. And I thought, that's the higher power I need right now. Just this higher power that loves me in my brokenness and wants to curl up on the pillow with me and be with me as I weep, and is so besotted with my wayward life and my good intentions and the hot mess that I am. And my spirit settled and soothed. And so that's kind of a step two story for me. And these things have happened multiple times, you know, wet and naked on a hotel room floor in some anonymous city, just crying my guts out, and someone from AA being on the speakerphone talking me through it and saying, you know, Ashley, in these moments, there's no book, there's no meeting, there's no sponsor, there's no, you know, quote from the podium. It's just down to your higher power in you, and what's it going to be? You know, in total surrender, with my literal physical body, total surrender. And then getting up and combing my hair and going someplace and being able to put one foot in front of the other with good orderly direction, which is one of my acronyms for higher power, and having that restored to sanity just over and over and over and over and over again. You know, and in step three, I like to link it to concept three, which says the right of decision makes effective leadership possible, because today I'm the leader of my own life. You know, alcoholism doesn't run my life. Other people don't run my life. Resentments against institutions and social ills don't run my life. I get to run my life with my higher powers help. And I have the right to make decisions that are in my own best interests. And I do that, for starters, by working the 12 steps, right? And advocating my own best interests. You know, increase my desire for what is good for me is one of my 11-step prayers. And so when I made that decision the first time with my sponsor, with her sweet little bony hands, we got down on our knees, it was the first real physical intimacy I'd had with another woman where I felt comfortable, you know, because I was real good on my own. Like, if you came to my house, I would sling hash for you, but you had to sit down and mind your manners at the table. I didn't know how to crack an egg with another woman at the stove. And today I'm in community and I'm in fellowship and I have a chosen family, because the first word of the first step is we. And it all started with that intimacy of getting on my knees with another woman in AA and turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood her at that time. And so, you know, what I'm reminded by a friend of mine in Nashville is that I make that decision once, but I can reconfirm that decision. I could go back and touch base with that decision over and over and over again. And how that also works in my life is I can trust myself to make big decisions. And I've done that multiple times, you know, to work abroad, to, you know, have a partner who's Swiss, to live in Africa, to go to graduate school, to, you know, make big decisions that had social impact. And I used the third step and the third concept and all of the other legacies as well every time I made those decisions. And I remember when I made this one consequential choice. And of course, I had talked to a lawyer, and of course, I had talked to all the different kinds of people doing my due diligence and taking an appropriate informed group conscience, not just randomly polling people to get the answer I wanted, but people who had the right kind of expertise on the subject. And I thought, you know, the most important decision I've ever made is to turn my will and my life over to the care of a higher power. Everything else is just going to sort itself out, and I'm going to be okay no matter what happens. And then, you know, step four and step 10, which are intimately related, and that reflection that I do, that radical self-inquiry where I really get to know myself as just a lovely person who sometimes says very unlovely things, right, and who has distorted ideas. But what I really kind of want to talk about with step four is how in my social behavior I use the traditions and the concepts to take that inventory. And there's a lot of ways that the book very explicitly suggests taking inventory. I ask myself certain questions. You know, where have I been dishonest, afraid? Where am I resentful? Where am I self-seeking? I always like that line from the fourth step in the book that says, where have I stepped on the toes of my fellows?
and they have retaliated. But I actually, if I look back, I see I set into motion trains of circumstance which I felt I didn't deserve. So I really appreciate all of those. But when I'm in the moment and doing the spot check inventory that's suggested in step 10, where I watch, and continue. The traditions and the concepts have been very valuable for me. So an example is, I was recently with my chosen sister, and she had graduated from graduate school, and we were having a beautiful celebration. I flew to her state to be with my bonus nieces and her, because I can pretend to care, but I can't pretend to show up, and she's shown up for me in major and minor moments of my life. And when we were sitting at the supper table, I thought, oh, I've got this funny picture from Berlin that I want to show my nieces, and they'll really get a kick out of it. And I passed the phone around, and they were like, I felt ashamed. I had like this little shame attack on the spot, like, this did not go as well as I thought it was going to. So I did a spot check inventory, and I said, you know what, that was an outside issue. That was like a tradition 10 principle. That photograph was inconsistent with the primary purpose for which we were sitting at that dinner table, which was to celebrate her graduation. And I had deviated from this primary purpose, brought in an outside issue, and set myself apart rather than being a part of. And so I thought, okay, that was that. And I got over my shame attack, and I rejoined the singleness of purpose, and I felt much better about myself. And so that's an example of using tradition 10, and obviously a reference to tradition 5, and you know, tradition 3, I'm a member of that family because I say I am and they welcome me. And then another example is, you know, my mom died not that long ago, and you know, his grieving looked pretty different from mine. And I could have had some judgment and opinions about that, right? Opinions. And what I decided was that I was going to apply tradition 4 and regard him as autonomous, right? He's an adult, and he gets to do things his way, and he even has the right to be wrong, as it says in our literature. And if his behavior affected me, like if he was squandering my mom's estate, or if he was, you know, doing things that implicated me, I would obviously have a need and a desire to address that with him. But he was just grieving in ways that felt inconsistent with my personal values. And what I decided was that I was going to use the general warranties of the conference in concept 12 and not put myself an unqualified authority over him. Because he has an authority in his life, which is his relationship with his higher power. And I don't have the authority to say, do this, don't do that, grieve this way, don't date her, that's too soon, whatever, you know. And my friends were more upset about his decisions than I was. And I also decided, you know, not to be personally punitive. And our literature asks me not to be personally punitive. And I realized that it wasn't what he was doing that affected me. It was my opinion of what he was doing that affected me, right? And so I let all that go. And the result was he ended up making some different choices over time and let go of the behavior in which he had engaged. But I didn't hurt our relationship. I didn't ding it, you know. I didn't nick it. I didn't get in there and mix it up. And I just am really grateful that I have all 36 of these legacies to help me make these choices about relationship. Because it says in step 8 in the 12 and 12 that relationships have been the cause of nearly all our woes, including our alcoholism, right? And of course that's because I can be selfish and self-centered, as it says in the big book in step 3. But those relationships really can heal when I apply the steps to myself and the traditions and the concepts to the relationships. You know, and it says also that I can have the best possible relations with nearly everyone I know. And that's a really tall order. And if I go through the steps, I can go through with it. Because relationships take two, right? And so that person may not be willing to be in the relationship with me, but I can comport myself with these keynotes that it talks about in step 10 in the 12 and 12, justice and courtesy and this kind of humanitarian love, where I may not like the person, but I can love them as having that fundamental idea of God deep inside of them, just like I have. So I want to talk a little bit about making that list in step 8, because I think step 8 can sometimes be a kind of unglamorous step. Everyone gets very worked up, or not everyone, but some people get really worked up about step 9 and making their amends. But I really enjoyed step 8 because I got to make three columns, is the way it was suggested to me. But in column one in my step eight is the person, if they walk through that door right now, I would be willing to make my amends to them. I feel good about it. I've read the literature. I've talked to my sponsor. I'm real clear where I've behaved in ways that were inconsistent with my highest values and aspirations and ideals. And then step two, column two is, I'm not quite there yet, but I'll get there, you know. And with time and talking with my sponsor and going, because I read step nine every time I make an amend. I just, in both the big book, not necessarily the whole way through in the 12 and 12. I would be misrepresenting myself if I said that, but I do read it in the big book. And then the third column is the really fun column, because it's the not no, but heck no column. I am not making amends to that person. No, thank you. And so that's a kind of kick in the pants. It's kind of like the column in the fourth step where everything they did wrong, you know? And the book gives me that grace. It says, yes, it's very clear that the world, it's evident that the world and its people are often quite wrong. Well, thank you. But then it also goes on to say, that's as far as some people ever go, and maybe I want to go further. Because the question I ask myself is, how free do I want to be? You know, how free do I want to be? And so there were people on that third column who migrated without my permission over to the willingness column. You know, they just kind of snuck their way over there as I continued to work, go on to step 10, 11, and 12. And two of those people were my mom and my dad. You know, I grew up in my childhood was just painful. I think that's the simplest word for it. It just really hurt, you know, it really hurt. And it was chaotic and dramatic, and, you know, it looked like my mom stealing me from my dad paying some cash for me to get me back at one point. And, you know, I lived in Tennessee and my dad was in Kentucky and he would come get me and mom would hide the car in the barn and lock all the doors and pull down the shades and turn off the lights and hide me under the bed. And dad would run around cussing and screaming and pounding on the doors and trying to break a window, you know, calling my mother every filthy name you can imagine. And that's just what my childhood looked like. And that's the short version of the story. And so how and why do I make amends to my parents? Well, I don't, I make amends for the rage that I carried as an adult and for those survival strategies that I developed that made my adult life unmanageable. You know, and it talks in the book about how we're waiting for a greater demonstration of these principles in our affairs and in our home relationships. And so it wasn't my fault that I had that childhood. It's not my fault that I have the disease of alcoholism. But I was taught that I become responsible for my recovery when I have the education and the resources and the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous to try to get better. And so I made my amends to my mom for the rage that I carried, which really damaged our relationship. You know, I was a full-blown rager. I was told that my rage preceded me before I walked into a room, that I vibrated with it, and that people were intimidated by me, which just made me madder because I didn't want to be intimidating. I wanted to be understood for how hurt I felt on the inside. And then with my dad, you know, I made my amends to him at a time when our relationship was not in great shape. He thought we were in a Beckett play or something, standing underneath a stoplight and exchanging these profound words. And I was like, Dad, this is my whole life. This is not, you know, stagecraft. And I didn't know if I was ever going to see him again. But I knew that I wanted to, if I was walking away from that relationship, do so with an integrity in my heart and an understanding that I couldn't do anything about him, but I sure as heck could do something about me. That I could do something about me. And so I said to my dad, I offer you my heartfelt amends for any and all wrongs I may have done. And that was as... that was both really deep and as deep as it got. And my dad and I ended up having a beautiful relationship after that. I went to graduate school here in town, and he came up, and we had a second go kind of at my adolescence. He made my breakfast. He packed my, you know, lunches. He pushed my Hello Kitty bike around campus. It was bright pink. He went to class with me. He read my papers. He was interested in the syllabi. And, you know, we really had this redo because I had been willing to follow the directions that are in this book and believe the miracles that had happened for other people, you know. And when my mom died and she harmed herself, and that was the manner of her death, I was with her. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that because it's super tender and really, you know, just to be there with someone when they're exhaling their last and being inhaled into the infinite mercy of God is an experience that I hope everyone can have at some point, but preferably not in the way that I did, you know. But I did get to sit there with her and hold her bloody body and tell her that I loved her and that all was forgiven long ago and that she, that I saw how much she suffered, and that it was really okay. And that's how my mom left this world, after her disease lied to her and stole her life. She knew that she was loved, and she knew that she was forgiven, and she knew that the shame that she had carried was not shame that I put on her anymore, you know. And that was a beautiful thing. And I also, I suppose I should reference drinking. It is an AA meeting. Never crossed my mind to drink over that or anything else. You know, the obsession has totally been lifted. And I'll also say to anyone who's new, welcome home. And you never have to drink again. And there's nothing a drink will make better, including a mother's death by suicide. And I also want to mention another story about getting through. I liked what Joel read in that line about calamity with serenity, sobriety, at least sobriety, maybe not serenity, but definitely with sobriety. I was in the Central African rainforest in the middle of the morning dark, and I fell and I broke my leg. It's kind of a long story, but we'll make it the short story here because my partner and I spend a lot of time there. And I'm an outdoors woman. I walk a lot. I came down Half Dome under a full moon once. It's not advisable, but I did it. And it's not unusual for me to be walking in the dark in the rainforest. But that day, my head torch was dim, and I couldn't see very well. There wasn't a lot of moonlight filtering through the canopy of the rainforest, and my leg broke in four places when I fell. And my foot was paralyzed, and I was hemorrhaging. And the moral of the story is someone had to come after I laid on the floor for a forest floor for 5 hours and reset the loose bones of my leg with his bare hands. And he did that not once, but twice, because it was shaped like the boomerang. And then I had to be carried on a piece of fabric for the rainforest for hours, and then I was put on a motorbike and had to hold my leg together with my hands on the motorbike for 5 hours over this bumpy little trail. And it took 67 hours to get pain medicine and to have any kind of medical intervention. But I was offered alcohol as a painkiller, Latoka, bush alcohol. And I was laying there in the dirt, just full of misery, you know, howling, screaming, back arching, in shock, wished I could pass out, never did. Ugh, ugh, ugh. So badly wanted to pass out. And someone said, you know, Mama Ashley, have some Latoka. And those 10-step promises that are written in the book were alive and well for me, because I reacted sanely and normally, and I, you know, and it just came to me. I recoiled as if from a hot flame. I didn't fight it. I didn't discuss it. It was just, no thank you. No thank. And how does a person in that position say thank you? No thank you. That's the grace of God right there. And I knew that I would come to a future meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and share with the newcomer that this program will work. You can bury children, you can lose a fortune, you can have climate disaster, you can be personally, morally, and spiritually bankrupt, and you can recover and you can stay sober. Because that was my experience. And it was a lot about that second step, too, because when I was lying there, you know, and my brothers were carrying me, and I didn't want to show pain because I didn't want them to feel bad about hurting me when they were crossing rivers, I knew that my higher power was suffering with me, because that's my higher power concept, because AA gives me that spaciousness and that grace of having a higher power concept that's personal to me. So I just want to close a little bit with step 11 and what that looks like in my life. I am waking up at the moment at 2:30 in the morning. I rustle around the covers for an hour, and then I wake up, and it's not unpleasant. I'm just awake. You know, I'm not ruminating. I'm not overwhelmed. And so I go downstairs and I do my program reading and some other recovery reading, and I write and I visit with my higher power. And the way I do that is how it's laid out in the book and what we sometimes call the morning pages, where it says, we sometimes select and memorize prayers which emphasize the ideals, the principles we have been discussing. And so I took the prayer from step 11 in the 12 and 12 and memorized it, and just very slowly go through every word. So it slows my brain and my breathing down, and it sounds like make me and instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, may I bring love. And so I just go through the whole thing very slowly like that. And if my attention wanders, because it's like a puppy, you know, it runs off, and I just gently bring it back and remember the last word where I left off. And if I can't, then just go back to the beginning of the prayer. And, you know, it says there are many helpful books, and there are lots of places to get recommendations for those helpful books. And so I've also chosen prayers from the world's great spiritual traditions and wisdom lineages and memorized those prayers. And that's my meditation practice. And then the way I pray for people is I just say step 11 because it's none of my business, right? And Bill cautions us against praying for outcomes even though my motives are really good, you know? So I just say, may my mother have knowledge of your will for her and may she have the power to carry that out. You know, may my niece who's been in the penitentiary for 8 years have knowledge of your will for her and the power to carry it out. Or I pray for their highest good. And for myself, a prayer I really love is just open my heart to your will. Just open my heart to your will. And that was really with me when I was in the forest and my leg was broken, you know. When I get to my edge, can I soften? Because I had a lot of hard edges when I got here, you know, and I want to be softer. And so what step 12 looks like in practicing the principles in all of my affairs is hopefully bringing those 36 legacies into everything, whether it's a board meeting, whether it's, you know, in the service work that I do, if it's in with family, and carrying the message with the women I sponsor. I have an hour with each one each week on Zoom, and then I do a traditions workshop for an hour and a half once a week. We had one today. And getting to speak at meetings like this, and the one at which I'm speaking at 10 o'clock tonight when I get back home. So that's really all I have for you tonight. I'm going to end a little bit early. I could keep talking, but what's the point? God is good, AA works, and we can stay sober, and meet calamity with serenity, or at least sobriety. Thank you so much.